again, let me thank you on behalf of my client, Mr. Trammell, as well as myself, the opportunity to argue this issue with the court. This is an aggravated assault deadly weapon case. Appellant Mr. Trammell was probation eligible. However, after a jury trial, the jury sentenced him to 6 years in the penitentiary after they found him guilty of the aggravated assault. I raised two issues in this case, the first of which is a denial of a self-defense jury charge, which was really the sole defensive issue in the case. And the second issue that I raise is a denial of a right to be represented by counsel of choice, which I think is kind of a more interesting issue because we don't see it very often. But I want to address both of them. The self-defense issue is obviously a huge concern when one reads the record. basically what happened is Mr. Trammell had gone with a friend of his to the victim's house. Apparently the victim and the friend of my client's had known each other, lived on the same street, lived in the same neighborhood, was apparently a drug dealer. That would be the victim's house. It was where people would go to use drugs, deal drugs, buy drugs, and ingest them. All of that's on the record, and it was sort of admitted by the victim and as well as testified to by the friend. The defendant, appellant, did not testify in the case. So all of this testimony is from the other witnesses. They go there, and the victim ingests methamphetamine. He's conducting drug deals. They are all drinking and smoking marijuana. At some point during the incident, and this is the same day as the aggravated assault occurred, nothing in the record specifically says how much earlier. They say a few hours earlier is the best I can glean from the record. The victim then explodes on the friend of my client, appellant's friend. They get into it, and it's apparently a pretty explosive incident. Get into a fight. Nobody's injured, but they exchange words. They exchange threats. My client jumps in between, stops the altercation, where that's when the victim's wrath sort of turns towards my client. Now everybody's into it, and my client and his friend then go to my client's car, which is a Caprice Classic, which kind of comes important later, and goes to leave. And there are threatening words exchanged at that time. The victim runs out, kicks the car. At some point, by one person's testimony, grabs a knife. By another person's testimony, grabs a hoe. Some instrument is threatening the appellant, my client, and they leave. A few hours later is when the incident actually occurs. What the evidence showed, according to that, is the victim is at his house with a crowd of individuals doing the things that they typically did at his house. He sees the Caprice Classic drive by. He's not thinking that it's a appellant's car. He's thinking that it's the cops. So immediately shuts the party down, closes the garage, and everybody scatters. That's when the victim gets in his car and drives down the road. Appellant is parked down the road in his car, not at the house of the victim, down the road. Victim drives up, realizes it's not the cops, but it's him. A verbal exchange occurs. We only have one side of that verbal exchange because it's from the victim's testimony. Defendant, my client, has a sawed-off shotgun in his vehicle, pulls it out, and shoots him. It goes through his bicep and through his chest. Not life-threatening injuries. In fact, when they asked the victim on the witness stand if he had been permanently disfigured by the shotgun blast to his bicep, he said yes, that he felt it looked better now. So not life-threatening injuries. Defendant then drives off, goes home, tells his mom and dad, is scared to death from the testimony. They call the police. No flight other than from the actual location to get away, but turns the gun over, turns the shotgun over, and talks to the police and turns himself in. That's basically the facts of the case. The issue that's raised here, there was a denial, there was a harsh request, in fact, from voir dire to the end of the trial to even the judge's comments in front of the jury. It was a self-defense case. I mean, that was the defense in this case. They voir dired on it extensively, opening statement. A lot of the questioning went to the self-defense issue. And, in fact, the judge told the jury that we need to take a break. We've got to work on the charge more because there's some issues concerning the self-defense issue. I think all of that points out the fact that was the whole defense in the case. And so to deny a charge on self-defense, given the facts of this case, is egregious.
What was the evidence of apparent danger?
I think the whole conduct, and I think the law is very clear, it doesn't have to be at that moment. I mean, once again, the victim testifies.
Was there evidence that he carried a gun? Or because so far the only weapon we've seen is a knife.
On the victim?
On the complainant, yeah.
Okay. I would say just the whole circumstances about his volatile temper, the fact he uses methamphetamine, he's not afraid to grab a weapon of choice. Just because the defendant did not see him with a gun at that time does not negate an apparent danger from a man that has such a violent temper, has threatened him. The victim testified that appellant was a punk, was definitely scared of him, that he was definitely a bigger guy. He could handle the situation. I mean, it was clear if you read the testimony that the person in control that was not fearful of anything was the victim. I mean, he also goes down to the vehicle and confronts the situation. Appellant doesn't confront the situation at the house. There's no testimony concerning why appellant was sitting down the street. So I guess that's a push. I mean, we can presume a lot of different things. Negative to my client, which could be he was sitting down there waiting for the guy to come confront him. Or it could be because he knew other people in the neighborhood, he was down there, and he just had the gun because of this prior situation hours earlier where the guy chases him out to the car, kicks his car. And I think what's important in that inquiry is there's case law that says the whole mass surroundings of the situation, it doesn't have to be just at the moment of the conduct, but it's everything. It's a compilation of all the events of that day that's important.
All right. We've been instructed that we can determine intent, all sorts of mental state from circumstantial evidence, that we treat circumstantial evidence the same as direct evidence, that there doesn't have to be direct evidence in order to convict.
Correct.
Does the same hold true for defensive issues? Does there have to be direct evidence, or do we look at circumstantial evidence to determine apparent danger?
I think absolutely.
Is there any case law that says that?
Well, I think it's indicated in the case law that talks about a model. I can't think of a case off the top of my head to be direct that says that's true, but there is case law that says, and it's cited in my brief, that we look at the totality of the circumstances and the relationship, also the case law that goes to the admissibility of the previous relationship of the parties. It's admissible because it's relevant in consideration of self-defense and what's going on in the actor's mind. Also, the law that says that it doesn't matter whether you believe the testimony or not, a modicum of credible or incredible testimony that even raises this issue allows a jury to be charged on it.
All right. In every drug possession case we get, practically, where there is a weapon within a mile of the drugs, there is an expert who comes and testifies that drug dealers carry guns. Can we take that into consideration as common knowledge, as knowledge that would be in the mind of appellant, or do we disregard that totally? Is that something that we consider as part of the circumstantial evidence or any other evidence?
Well, of course, I would agree with that. You know, that's amenable to my side, but I do think, realistically speaking, we're seeing that in all these warrants that we see on drug houses, that it's common knowledge that for the officers' protections to run these warrants, that there's guns involved. They're putting those, like everybody knows, that people that have drugs protect those drugs with guns or protects people that might rob them with guns. I do think that's common knowledge, and I think that's something that you can consider. However, I'll be honest with the court, there's nothing in this particular record that actually says that. I mean, they discuss the fact that he's hiding stuff from the cops by closing the garage, you know, didn't want the police officers in his house, and clearly he's a drug dealer and using drugs. There's not a mention of a gun in this record. But I do think it's common knowledge that the police utilize against defendants all the time in drug cases, and I do think it's common knowledge. I would be more comfortable if they'd asked that question.
It does seem that the appellant's reasonable belief has to be, in this case, or we have to conclude, that the victim had a gun when he drove up beside him? Because he didn't get out of his car, did he?
He did not get out of the car.
They're facing each other.
Correct.
And there's no evidence that he got out of his car, approached appellant's car, or took any other action that would lead him to reasonably believe that force was necessary.
Well, I don't. I
gun down there somewhere.
See, I would disagree with that. But that's my position, because I believe the law requires only a modicum of evidence to believe he had a reasonable belief of fear. And I think the fact that this guy was explosive, confronting the situation, was not in fear of him at all. In fact, this guy, my client, was scared by all the testimony of the other guy. And the other guy comes up, he's confronting the situation. I think it's a clearly reasonable deduction from the evidence that the gun was there because he wasn't going to go in the neighborhood without some protection just out of the mere fear of this guy. Because even the victim says, yeah, he was scared of me, and he was kind of proud of it in the way he testified. He's a punk. Of course he was afraid of me. If he wants to fight it out any time, I'm game. And so I don't think you have to believe, or there has to be some evidence that he had a gun, to raise an issue of self-defense jury charge going to a jury. That might be whether or not the evidence was sufficient to sustain a finding of self-defense. But under the law, we're talking about whether or not a jury just even gives an option to consider that. And the law says just a modicum of evidence that shows a reasonable fear in somebody's mind is sufficient to raise that issue to go to a jury in the jury charge. The judge didn't even allow that to be presented to the jury for the jury to consider whether or not they wanted to believe it. And I think that's where the court egregiously erred in this case. And this man didn't get a fair trial based on that fact. If there's any more issues on the self-defense.
What were the threatening words the complainant used? You said there were threatening words he used.
Yeah, he said things
squab
like...
Squab it out. What is squab
yeah,
it out?
Yeah, you want to squab it out. It's another word
squabble?
For fight. You know, fight. You and I'll go at it. We'll just... you and I'll handle it by fighting it out one way or the other. People could interpret it many different ways, whether it's with a weapon or not. Yeah, we can just fight it out. And he said that quite a number of times to the guy.
Was there ever any threat to kill or to use weapons other than fists?
Well, when he grabbed the weapon at the house, there was a threat there, I think, other than fists, either a knife or a hoe, when he kicked the car. But I think attendant in the whole factual circumstances is that there's a threat to use more than that. Okay. I'll go on to point two now. The second issue is kind of interesting. I've never seen this happen before, but apparently what had occurred was the court-appointed attorney who represented Mr. Trammell had some pretrial hearings with the court, and I think you can read the record and see that she was kind of getting eaten up a bit, perhaps a little overhead in the proceedings. Let's just put it like that. She had called on a friend to help her with the case, another lawyer, actually a lawyer who'd been a judge, and one who'd been licensed a long time but wasn't on the wheel. The other lawyer was just going to help her because she had at least more experience as licensed, and you know it was clear from the record, and I'd ask you to read the record, that the other lawyer was kind of getting beaten down a bit. And so when she came to sit with her, the judge would not allow the other attorney to sit based on the fact that she wasn't on the wheel to be appointed. But the record was replete that she was not requesting to be appointed. She was not asking for any money. She wasn't doing anything other than there to help represent the client in his defense.
Isn't that how you get qualified to be on the wheel, by sitting second chair with people who are on the wheel?
Absolutely, and they do it all the time. And we offer our services all the time in that regard. But what's more interesting in this case is it never says that lawyer was not qualified to be on the wheel. It says she wasn't on the wheel. And as I'm sure y'all are aware, a lot of us sometimes don't choose to be on some of the wheels on some of the cases. So I'm not sure whether she was qualified or not. There was some mention of that's how, you know, we get qualified is to sit with other lawyers. And but the judge just absolutely denied it. And I'll have to readdress that when I come back.
Thank you, Ms. Mullen. Ms. Windsor.
May it please the court. I want to clear up one thing. I think we have a disagreement, and the court's just going to have to look at the record, but I would cite to the record, at least in my brief, I have the reporter's record 2 at 7. Ms. Johnson informed the trial court she did not have the necessary qualifications to be appointed to the case. So I don't believe she was qualified under the wheel.
But she wasn't asking to be appointed.
She wasn't asking to be appointed, but she was asking to represent the defendant in a case where he had appointed counsel. And I want to make a distinction. I mean, when I first got this brief, I thought, you know, this is crazy. What's going on here? But the problem in this case, he had appointed counsel. There's a distinction when you have appointed counsel or you have retained counsel. If he had retained counsel, another attorney comes with his counsel, wants to sit second chair, I think the trial court would have had to allow her to do that. It's different with appointed counsel, though, because the statute talks about the requirements appointed counsel have to have to be qualified to handle a case. This attorney wasn't qualified. She could not have been appointed to the case because of that. She wasn't asking to be appointed, but she was asking to represent him. And basically, you know, I mean, there's so many issues that come out of this. Number one, if his appointed attorney had felt like she needed help, she could have moved for the appointment of additional qualified attorney.
Racehorse Haynes isn't on the wheel. He couldn't sit second chair to help a lawyer who felt like she was under the gun?
Not without the trial court's permission, no.
Where does it say that? Nowhere does it say if they're not appointed, they can't sit pro bono.
You don't have, if you have appointed counsel, you don't have the right to choice of counsel.
Well?
Under the Constitution.
You don't have the right to appointed counsel, to choose your appointed counsel. But you can certainly hire somebody to come in and assist or there's nothing that says you can't have somebody pro bono.
And if you want to hire someone to come in and assist, or you want to have somebody come in and pro bono, then at that point you have effectively retained counsel. And
where
you
does
can
it
have
say
one
a pro bono lawyer is retained?
Well, if the court looks at one case where it sort of comes up is a Fort Worth case that I believe is Bryant, was the case where the attorney appeared as attorney of record. Her law firm, she apparently wasn't paid, but she appeared as attorney of record. The law firm was later appointed, and one of her partners or her senior partner was appointed to represent the defendant. And basically in that case, this court talked about, you know, number one, she wasn't appointed to the case, so she wasn't entitled to be paid as appointed counsel. The person who was appointed to the case wasn't entitled to be paid because he didn't actually appear in the case. Because she had appeared on behalf, he basically didn't have the right to appointing counsel because he had an attorney in the case. And so, you know, what the fee arrangements are is a private matter as far as retained counsel goes. But if a trial court is appointed attorney, that attorney can't just assume the responsibilities of the trial court and go and delegate some of her appointed counsel responsibilities or just decide who she's going to effectively.
They do that in appeals all the time. They associate lawyers to help with appeals all the time.
If the court wants to allow it, I think it's up to the court, but under the Code of Criminal Procedure, there are strict requirements for appointed attorneys. The problem with it is if she appears, she's not appointed, she's retained, so he's got this hybrid representation of appointed counsel, retained counsel. If there's a conflict between the counsels, what controls? If this attorney who's come into the case, who's not qualified to be on the case, messes up and is ineffective, I mean, is, you know, it's his, he's the one who chose him, but does he have some sort of complaint against the trial court that, well, you appointed me somebody who's not qualified? I mean, maybe it doesn't rise to the level of ineffective assistance of counsel.
But the trial court,
but you've basically
appointed,
recognized and that I needed another attorney by allowing this attorney to appear, but you gave me somebody who wasn't qualified instead of appointing somebody who was when I was entitled to appointed counsel.
He has appointed counsel.
He has appointed counsel. He has appointed counsel.
This is a volunteer assistant pro bono.
It may be a volunteer assistant pro bono. He has appointed counsel. There's no suggestion that appointed counsel needed another attorney appointed to the case. If she had, she could have filed a motion, had another attorney appointed. He just wasn't entitled to choose that attorney.
Wouldn't it be like the situation where you have, whether it's appointed or retained, and then the defendant wants to also file pleadings pro se? I mean,
I think it's exactly.
I mean, then you have total confusion.
You have total confusion. That's exactly the problem.
And also, wouldn't it build in a point of error on appeal? I could see some of those coming in. Like you said, if they disagreed on how to strategize on a particular issue.
And that, and I think that's got to be part of the trial court's concern is, well, you know, is he, what is this attorney's role? Has he effectively retained her, whatever their private fee arrangements are? If he's retained an attorney, that attorney is his, should substitute in. He can have retained attorney or he can have appointed counsel, but he can't have retained and appointed counsel in the same case. That's effectively what they were asking to do.
So when Barry Schenck comes out down and helps out the people in the Innocence Project over in Dallas that Craig Watkins is running, you're saying that if he came across the county line to Tarrant County, he wouldn't be able to help out?
I'm saying if he came across to Tarrant County, he can choose to either represent pro bono and there not be an appointed counsel, which is the cases that I've seen the way it happens in those big high-profile cases, they do it pro bono, or he can request to be appointed. And if he meets the requirements and the judge appoints him, then he can. But you can't have it, you can't request appointed counsel and pick who you want. You can request appointed counsel, you get a qualified attorney from the wheel.
You can't pick who you want if it's appointed. But in this case, I thought they made real clear it was counsel who was requesting assistance and not asking that the person be appointed, and I think that's a totally different situation.
Well, if she's not requesting to be appointed, then effectively she's retained. She has to have some role in the proceeding. She's either appointed or retained. If she's retained, he has the means to retain an attorney, and he's no longer entitled to appointed counsel. And I think the trial court's concern is, what do you do if there's a disagreement? What if in the middle of trial he doesn't like appointed counsel anymore?
But that's what you have any time you've got more than one lawyer. I mean, don't you know the state doesn't always, co-counsel don't always agree in a prosecution in the state.
Certainly.
And that's never been held a reason for
but
the state.
But unfortunately,
not to have two
the
lawyers.
State can't always appeal those kinds of when those kinds of issues arise, but the defendant can. And so I think the trial court can. Judicial economy basically can look out for the interest of the whatever judgment that could come along and decide to
limit the number of lawyers.
Excuse me?
Limit the number of lawyers a defendant has?
If she had been retained, they could have brought whoever they wanted in there. But since she was appointed, appointed counsel can't assume the responsibilities and the authority of the trial court and just go pick who they want to come in to the case. I mean, what if appointed counsel, somebody gets appointed as counsel and, you know, I really don't have time to deal with this. I'm just going to bring somebody in who's not qualified on the wheel and I'm just going to let them handle everything. I think the defendant has a huge complaint that, well, you know, I've got this other attorney and they're effectively the one who's representing me and they're not qualified. And so I think that the trial court has to guard its responsibility in choosing qualified appointed counsel. You know, again, if he had retained counsel, different story. But where you have appointed counsel, appointed counsel is the one who represents. If appointed counsel feels that additional counsel are needed, they can move the trial court and ask that somebody else be appointed. She moved for the appointment of investigator. So, you know, there's no suggestion that she wouldn't have done that if she felt it was necessary. I don't know why. It could be this since this person wasn't qualified, she was trying to get experience to get on the wheel. I mean, that's speculation. I don't know if that exactly what the circumstances are, but I know that that does go on in some courts. But it presents a problem. I mean, if you have somebody who's not qualified, who's representing somebody in court, and it's their appointed counsel who brings them in, then I think it goes back to the trial court. You know, you're usurping the trial court's authority as far as...
Did the appellant ever ask for this extra lawyer?
He had never asked before. She showed up that day.
On that day, did appellant specifically ask for this lawyer?
I don't remember one way or the other.
Counsel.
I don't remember I don't remember exactly. I don't want to say because I don't remember exactly what his words on the matter were. But in any event, you're not entitled to appointed and retained counsel. You don't have a choice.
You don't
think
it makes a difference
counsel?
Whether it's the defendant who's asking for the lawyer or the appointed lawyer who's asking for the lawyer?
I don't. I think he had a choice of retained counsel or appointed counsel. He can't have both. And his appointed counsel can't assume the responsibilities of the trial court.
Well, if you can find a case that tells me that he can't have both appointed and retained, I'd like to see it.
Well, I think you can look at any of the U.S. Supreme Court cases.
I'm talking about Texas
and
law.
I think that's pretty clear. I don't think that that's... I'll look through here, but that's not in dispute. I've got...
I think it is.
Well, you're not entitled to hybrid representation.
That's the defendant and a lawyer. Although Texas Constitution says you're entitled to be heard by counsel, in person, or both, which does suggest that our Constitution does allow hybrid representation, but our courts have interpreted it differently. But appointed lawyer and retained lawyer, I don't know what case law says that you can't have both.
Well, the Code of Criminal Procedure, number one, says you can't have both, because if you can, under 26.04, if you've got the ability to retain counsel, you're not entitled to appointed counsel. So the Article 26.04, I believe it is, but it's the Code of Criminal Procedure, says that...
We're beating this dead horse, because it's still, the no money's changed hands. It's a volunteer pro bono. And so it's not the same as retained, because that goes to the question of indigence, whether you've destroyed your own claim of indigence. But anyway, you want to talk to us about...
Self-defense, I just don't think that this case gets there. I understand that it was, and I agree that appeared to be their defense that they were trying to present at trial, but just because you're trying to present something doesn't entitle you to a charge. There has to be some evidence to support it. There was no evidence to support self-defense in this case. Basically, you can't... And I'll go back, and I had written a note down that Justice Stefano, you had a question about can you get intent from circumstantial evidence? And I think, sure, you can. It doesn't have to be direct evidence because the reason I say that, there are cases that talk about the evidence to support a charge of self-defense does not have to come from the defendant himself. So I think anything doesn't come in from the defendants is not going to be direct evidence. But you do have to have some evidence to support it. And we don't have that there. We've got no evidence that he believed the shooting was necessary to defend himself. We have no evidence that the victim was attempting to use, or that the appellant believed he was using deadly force when he shot him.
Can we take as common knowledge the fact that drug dealers carry guns?
I don't think you can. I think... where that comes in is you can take into common knowledge drug dealers may carry guns, but we certainly don't get deadly weapon findings in drug cases when there's no evidence of a gun. I mean, sure, everybody knows that they might have had a gun, they probably had a gun, but unless you have a gun, you don't get a deadly weapon finding. Does it mean that the police can get a warrant, a no-knock warrant, under certain circumstances, sure, because that's a whole different thing. You're not making a judicial finding that somebody is in possession of something. You're trying to protect the safety of the officers in entering a house. I don't think that gets you there in this case. The other evidence, the first scuffle they had, it was a lot of pushing and a lot of posturing, but in the end, the victim told the guy, "We can fight or you can leave." And I see my time is up. If the court has no further questions, the state would pray this case be affirmed.
Thank you, Ms. Windsor. Ms. Mullen.
Thank you. The precedent that's involved in the second issue is extremely important. It's very important to me as a litigant that represents a lot of indigent clients, and it concerns me a great deal. So I'd ask the court to carefully, I'm sure you do look at every issue, but we got to be aware that this new system and the number of defendants that we're dealing with and the number of people that are representing these defendants, that even though they're qualified under the wheel, lack the ability to truly, in a lot of regards, fight for these people like a person that has a lot of money might be able to be fought for, concerns me. It's a system that I hope concerns all of us. This is our system of justice, and I think we can all agree that we are dedicated that the poor get represented as effectively as the rich. I mean, we know they have to stay in jail more than the rich who can post bond, but it's a major issue that we're looking at here. And what we're doing, if you really stand back and look at this, is what we're saying, if you want to agree with the state, is that if I get hired by somebody because he happens to have enough money to hire me, he has that good fortune in his life, so he can pay me money, then I can get in and bring him all the attorneys in the world that are willing to come help pro bono. He has that luxury because he's rich, I guess. But the little dude that's sitting in jail that has zero money, if I get appointed to represent him, and then I can go out and cajole the best of the best to come help me defend this man to the best of my ability, a judge can deny that. And that's wrong. And it's very, very important that we think about that, because that little guy deserves to be represented. And let's cut through everything. Sharon Wilson would have never appointed a second chair attorney on a case like this. It's an aggravated assault. It's a second degree felony. If that lawyer had asked for an appointed counsel to sit, it wouldn't have happened. So she gets somebody to help, because you can tell from the record she is over her head a bit. I don't want to say anything bad about a lawyer, but the judge is eating her alive. She's not winning anything. And she's trying to get help for this little guy. So she's having somebody come sit with her, and anybody to help her would have been better than nothing. I don't think it's fair. I think it's a constitutional due process violation. And I think under this shroud of, oh, we have this wheel, so those people are more qualified, so I can't allow you to pro bono sit with him. So I'm helping you, actually. I'm helping little poor guy because she's not qualified. It's totally inapplicable. It's duplicitous. It doesn't make any sense. He's entitled, if somebody wants to pitch in and help, to have that second attorney help. And just because he's poor and can't afford it doesn't mean an attorney can't help. And a judge can't deny that, thank goodness, because we have a state and federal constitutional right to have that little guy have as many attorneys who are willing to pitch in, not retained, pro bono, for free, even with an appointed attorney. So I'd really ask you to consider, I didn't mean to get this upset, but it's just because he doesn't have enough money to hire an attorney. If you have any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Mullen. Thank you, Ms. Windsor. We appreciate your arguments and your briefing today. Your case is submitted. That completes our cases for the 9 o'clock docket. We'll adjourn until 10:30.